En nú komið að næsta fyrirlesara sem ég veit að innvígðir Linux-menn bíða spenntir eftir. En það engin annar en Alan Cox, einn helsti forritari Linux-kjarnans eins og kom fram hjá Bruce hér. Kemur næstur á eftir Linux sjálfum. Alan rekur Linux-þróunarfyrirtæki í Bretlandi og vinnur fyrst og fremst fyrir Red Hat sem verktaki. Fyrrum vinnuveitendur hans eru meðalans 3.com þar sem hann forritaði beina eða router búnað. Fyrirtæki sem heitir NTL þar sem hann starfaði við að koma út virgin.net og vits.net og einnig sem ég tæknilegur tæknilegur svona manager fyrir simru.net sem fyrirtæki Wales og hann með BS gráðu í tölvunarfræðum frá háskólanum í Wales I know we can look forward to a very interesting speech Mr. Alan Cox
Okay, hello. If I start to talk too fast, I'll do my best not to, but do warn me. My accent isn't the clearest of English accents anyway. Right. Okay, hang on a minute. Just investigate the microphones a minute. Okay, I think we're stuck with this one, are we? Okay. The first one I look at is look at my slides here as well so I can see that's better oh technology okay can you hear that
oh yes
okay right that's better I can walk around now. The topics I want to talk about More technology. This technology doesn't... Oh, it does work. play with this. Yeah, okay. I don't think I need this.
That's nice.
Yeah. The things I first want to talk about is where Linux actually came from originally. Then I would talk about the things Linux is good for. Things that Linux handles particularly well, applications where Linux makes sense to use it. The next thing I want to talk about after that is things that we are doing for the future, things Linux doesn't do well at the moment. This is one good thing about free software. Because it's based on support, because the business is about the support business, not about selling you things you don't want, I can actually stand here and tell you things you should not use Linux for. And nobody will complain. No one from marketing will object. Having looked at the things we need and how we intend to get there, I finish off by looking at how the Linux development model works, how the kernel actually manages to get written. Okay, we start with a quick history lesson. The first Linux kernels, which is those before Linux 1.0, were very much a hobby thing. Linus originally wanted something better than Minix, which he could log into his internet account, preferably be able to read his mail from, and a few other things. The initial Linux releases that went up on the internet were very, very primitive indeed. And the early kernels before Linux 1.0, it was adding things that people would take for granted now with Linux, with Unix. Job control, even things like the multiple virtual consoles, which is something most Linux people are used to, although perhaps people from other Unixes find as a feature, were not present at this time. And nobody had any idea that Linux was going to become a big commercial thing. There was no interest at the time in how do we make it run Oracle. This was completely and utterly out of consideration. It was, how do I make it play NetHack? Can I read news on it? I just ported my new email client to Linux. This was the level of things going on. Eventually, the Linux networking stabilized, which was the last part, and Linux 1.0 was released. It was being aimed really at people with 386, maybe 4 megabytes of memory, which was a fairly reasonable machine at the time. And it worked. It was just about usable for some commercial applications. A few people were using it as a web server in the early days of the web, and mail server. There was not a great deal of serious commercial use of Linux at this time. The next release of Linux, which is actually a stable release, was Linux 1.2. And why I talk about this, if you look at the version numbers, there's the cute pen thing. Right. If you'll notice, 1.0, 1.2, 2.0, 2.2, they're all even numbers. The Linux kernel is developed with development releases using odd numbers and actual release quality versions using even numbers. So that's why there isn't a 1.1 on the chart. Linux 1.2 was the first useful Linux operating system. It was at the point people were using it for terminal servers, web servers. Internet providers were beginning to use Linux quite seriously by this point. Linux 1.2 was good for small machines, only PC-type machines, didn't handle multiprocessing, didn't handle large amounts of memory, didn't handle large disks. Linux 2.0 is the one perhaps most people who here have used Linux will be most familiar with. It's what all of the vendors currently release up until probably about now. The first Linux 2.2 releases on CD are just coming out. This is the kernel that's good enough to run Oracle and all the commercial applications. Linux 2.0 is effectively the real Linux for business, Linux for commercial use. And Linux 2.2 is the latest Linux. Was much more scalable, multiprocessor machines. Linux 2.0 supported Intel and Alpha machines. Linux 2.2 supports Intel, Alpha, UltraSpark, most of the big modern machines, except for the Hewlett-Packard PA RISC machines, which is something which is starting to change. But for those, you're stuck with HP UX at the moment. We do plan to save you. Okay, the things Linux is good at, first of all, so we might as well tell the nice story first. Firstly, it's very, very efficient. Linux is written by people who, most of whom, paid for their hardware. This actually makes quite a difference. Instead of telling you, go and buy a better SCSI controller, these people said, I can't afford a better SCSI controller. I will fix my existing SCSI controller. So there's a continued pressure to be efficient to support old hardware. That's something you don't see. If you look at, say, Solaris on Intel, or Unixware, less so SCO because of its age, you will see that the hardware choice you have is very limited. On Linux, the hardware choice you have tends to be much wider. And although it's not really any wider for high-performance devices, it is much wider for low-end, for cheap equipment. We support lots of really, really terrible pieces of old hardware. The kind of things that someone should have thrown out but didn't. Linux is multiple architecture. We support a lot of platforms. Very few other Unixes now support more than a couple. Solaris is Intel or Spark. Most of the others, like Digital Unix or HP UX, you get with the vendor's hardware, and you've got no way, if you need a bigger machine or a smaller machine, you have to choose another operating system variant for each of your hardware. With Linux, you don't have to do that. You can run Linux on an Alpha, on a 12-processor UltraSpark, or on a 386 with 4 megabytes of memory. It works on all of them. So it will run on your big database machine. It will run on the machine that's lurking in the back of the cupboard that the secretary can no longer run Word on. We support a lot of file protocols, a lot of network protocols. In the earlier days especially, Linux always was the incomer. Linux always needed to support what was already there. The result of this is that Linux can interwork with NetWare, with Windows 95 and Windows NT, although Microsoft keep trying to make that break mysteriously, and also with Unix machines, and finally even with Macintoshes, with AppleTalk. Linux has always had to make the effort to talk to other systems. So it's very rich, even both in the kernel and in user space, with tools to talk to other computers. Finally, it's very cost-effective, because Linux is built out itself, but not just the kernel, but all the tools around it, out of free software. So not only is the Linux kernel free, which is only one tiny part of what you need, everything else that surrounds it, your development kit, your windowing environment, your mail tools, are all under the same kind of licenses. So you have a situation where you don't have to pay for each user for your mail system, each user for your file system. Your mail software, your web server, all came with the system. It's very, very cost effective. Okay, this is the bit that other companies don't show you. Things we don't do well. The most obvious one now, as disk prices fall and fall, is a thing called journaling. Journaling is what is used on bigger machines, particularly things like AIX. Solaris now has this. And they record a list of changes made to the file system. And this record is kept up to date, and between any two points when you're updating this log, you know that what is on your disk is correct. If you like, you've got the disk at one time and the disk at another time. At any point, you can always go back to the previous time. So if somebody turns your machine off, as people always do, that's not running Windows. I can't see the prompt. I'll just turn this computer off for you. You don't have this problem of a very, very long wait while your disks are checked. The file system checker in Linux for a big disk may take perhaps 10, 15 minutes to check all your machine. It's not a big deal because Linux doesn't crash very often. But if you have very large file systems, as big database people need, like half a terabyte, you get to the point where it would take 4 or 5 hours for your Linux box to reboot. And at that point, clearly you want some other system at the moment, at least until Linux itself acquires journaling. Lots of the other big systems have it. IBM make a huge feature out of this. Even NT has journaling of sorts. It's one area we're really lacking. Related to this is a thing called logical volume management, which, again, anyone who's used AIX will be very familiar with. You partition your disk. You install your big database. It doesn't fit. In the normal world, the PC world, the Linux world, you take all of your data, you put it on a tape, you partition your disk again, you restore all your data. A month later, it doesn't fit, and you may potentially have to do something similar. The way IBM solve this is you can actually dynamically alter the size of the partitions on your disk. So if your users are running out of disk space and you have vast amounts of spare space elsewhere, you can grow the user disk. You don't need to go dumping to tape. You simply go into a configuration tool and say, give the users a bit more disk space, hit the OK button, and it's done. So these are the big disks, the big server management issues, and Linux for the moment is a bad choice if you are dealing with really huge amounts of data. These are the order of hundreds of gigabytes or terabytes of data. You can use Linux as a client to those kind of systems over NFS or a database client, but you don't want to have your terabyte of data on a Linux box. Not yet. 64-bit files. Now, a long time ago, somebody had this wonderful idea that any file would be no longer than 32 bits, which gives you 4 gigabytes. And because in Unix, one of them is used for a sign, you can move backwards and forwards in files. A standard Unix system only allows you 2 gigabytes in a single file. Now, to be fair to people, this decision was made in the early 1970s. So at the time, a 40 megabyte disk was about the size of a large truck. So it was a reasonable decision once upon a time. Nowadays, a 2 gigabyte disk is actually hard to buy. People don't make them anymore. So this is becoming an issue. Not just for Linux, but for all the Unix vendors. Some of them now support a thing. It's called the 64-bit file extensions, and there are a set of calls for dealing with large files. Linux supports those on the UltraSpark and on the Alpha, but not yet on 32-bit machines, which means the PC can't handle a single file over 2 gigabytes. This is another thing which will be corrected in the future. It's rarely a problem, but it is occasionally worth bearing in mind, again, for dealing with very large file systems. The final thing we really lack is also file system related. Now, how many people here are familiar with the SGI machines? We have one. Two. Okay. SGI made a lot of business success out of handling large, very, very large, high-performance video and video type applications. And one of the reasons they can do this is they added some extensions to the standard Unix operating system model for disk I/O. On a normal Unix system, file operations are done into a thing called the disk cache, which is much like a disk cache on NT or any other system. There are certain kinds of operations, like video, where you know that you do not need the previous piece of film in your disk cache. It was not worth copying into your disk cache, and because you've been copying it in your disk cache, you just miss the next 3 or 4 frames of your video. And so what they actually do is to allow applications to do video directly into the application's memory space. So the disk control hardware is feeding data directly to the application without the operating system getting in the way so much. This is also being added to Linux for 2.3. I sort of covered some of this by accident talking about the last slide. Never mind. The things actually going on, the extended 3 file system is to add the journaling to the existing Linux file system, the main Linux file system called X2. There was an extended file system before that. The extended file system died several years ago because it wasn't good enough. Extended 2 came from it. Extended 3 will come from that. There is a German project called DTFS, which is a log-structured file system, which is another way of doing file systems, which is very, very good if you have a lot of memory and is really aimed at things like network file servers. It has the same ideas, the same properties that you can just turn the machine off by accident, turn it on again, and continue to operate. And we have RiserFS, which is under development. This is done by someone who believes that instead of databases sitting on top of a file system, the file system should sit on top of a database. And so it is a file system which is built using database technology. And again, this will offer journaling facilities. All of these are a year away or so. So they're useful to know about, but they're not useful for immediate planning of business decisions. Ingo Molnar, who's a Hungarian, is working on the logical volume management. That's the being able to resize parts of your disk. And Ted So, who one of the people who originally wrote the extended file system, has written tools which allow you to resize it. Currently, those are commercial and part of a tool called Partition Magic, but they will become free in about, I think, 6 months' time from now. So all the Linux vendors will then start to ship these tools. The 64-bit file systems are being worked on by people in Hungary, by people in Finland mostly this time, and various other parts of the world. And there's long-term interest in clustering. This is not like the Beowulfs. Beowulf is a Linux model where you use the fact that PC hardware is extremely cheap, and instead of buying a very big mainframe, you buy 200 Linux boxes, a very fast network, and a big room, and you simply wire them all together. It's been used by people like NASA and the US military. It's very, very cost-effective for certain kind of problems. But the kind of clustering that the word normally means is different. This is clustering where one of your machines falls over and the rest of the system carries on, and the services move onto the nodes which are still running. VMS was very big on this. Digital Unix has similar facilities. So you can build a fault-tolerant system. Someone can actually steal one node of your cluster, and your Oracle database continues to run. Okay, this is the second part of the talk. How long have I got left? Okay, right. Maybe I have been talking a bit too fast. Okay, the Linux development model is very, very different to a conventional business model. I've worked for people like 3Com, where you invented a product, marketing took it away, sold something different to the customer, and then told you to write it. The Linux model doesn't work like this. It's driven almost entirely by the users. There is no company saying, if we add this feature, we could sell it to lots of people who don't need it. The people who are driving it are mostly people saying, I've got this television card. I'd like to watch television on Linux. I wonder if I can find the documentation. So it reflects what people want to do with it. There is some stuff which is driven by companies. What tends to happen there is some company says, Linux is cheap, it's fast, but we need to do this with it. I know, we'll pay somebody to add that facility. And they can do this, they can go to anybody they like. Even if you're in Iceland, you can go to someone in Iceland and say, please add this feature to the Linux operating system. You don't have to go to talk to this guy in Redmond. There is no central control over development of the Linux kernel. People simply make the changes they need. The control aspect is what things get into the mainstream kernel. And that's really purely a technical and quality control issue. So that if people write something which is a quick solution, which is messy, it probably will never get into the mainstream kernel. They may not care. If it's a device driver for someone's unique piece of hardware and it's messy, nobody else wants to know about the driver anyway. Nobody needs care. It works. If it's something which is going into the mainstream kernel, it has to be maintainable, it has to be modular, and preferably it has to be small and efficient, although sometimes you can't actually manage that. Some hardware is just too bad. Linux tends to favour very much simple and well-documented technology. If you look at developments in Linux, you will see where there are devices or protocols which are very simple, very clean, then they tend to get into Linux very fast. Where there are complicated protocols with layers that really shouldn't have been there in the first place, which are obviously designed by people who aren't going to have to write the code, Linux tends to lag more. Universal Serial Bus is a beautiful example of this. It's a fantastically well-designed piece of hardware. Unfortunately, somebody got between the hardware engineers and the operating system designers, and the specifications are about 600 pages. It takes about 80 pages to describe how a USB joystick works. Right? And all of the kinds of joystick you might want to have, everything from a surfboard you can stand on to a conventional left, right, up, down joystick with the fire button, they're all in the specification. And these kind of things Linux tends to lag on. The universal serial bus in Linux is very much at a development stage, and these kind of things are why. So Linux actually tends to favour well-designed systems. Another real difference is that old device drivers never die. So long as one person cares about some particular piece of hardware, they can maintain it. If anyone's ever found that from like with a Windows upgrade, you went from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95, and your video card was no longer supported, or your sound card was no longer supported. The commercial vendors often have a very awkward time with this because it costs them real money to support your hardware. Even the Windows market, which, unlike the Unix market, there is at least a very large volume, there is a real cost to supporting old hardware. In the Linux world, the cost is it's a time cost. And so long as someone has the time, or more likely someone doesn't have the money to fix the problem with new hardware, device drivers stay maintained. We support 14 or 15-year-old 3COM Ethernet cards. And people still use them because they're incredibly cheap. You get them like 20 in a box, don't you dare bring them back. And this is the normal pricing for that kind of hardware. We also support the IBM PS2 machines, which were probably one of IBM's greatest flops. Pretty much nothing else supports the PS2. Old versions of AIX did, but not anymore. Linux supports the PS2 because lots of people found you can buy a skipful of PS2 machines at, well, I don't know what comes out in Icelandic, but it's about £5 a skipful. You actually pay for the metal value of these machines. Students love it. So we have a hierarchical development model. It was not designed that way. It just happened. Patches generally go to people concerned with a given area of the kernel. And those people may then say, well, that's nice, but perhaps these changes would be better. Occasionally they say things like, oh my God, go away, don't send me anything like that again. But not that often. Because even when you get bad code from someone, it normally means someone is making the time, making the effort, they're worth teaching why their code is bad, where it would be improved. So as the code rises through the tree of people who maintain things, in theory it gets better. Generally that actually works to be the case. And eventually everything goes through Linus Torvalds, every single kernel change. He likes it that way. By the time things hit him, they are normally clearly labelled, very clean, and organised patches. But he wants to be in a situation where he knows every single thing which is going on in the kernel. So he sees the entire big picture. It's his time. And if he wants to do it that way, he's welcome to. The last, perhaps, real difference between the Linux model and most commercial NT and Unix development models is that they are implementation-oriented. That is, if you have got the code for a driver, and there are 12 other people saying, I haven't got the code yet, but I have this really good idea how it should be done. And if anyone's worked for a large company, you'll be familiar with this one. Then the person who has the code almost always wins. Because working code is always better than 12 people sitting on a mailing list saying, but if you did it this way... So it's very, very practically oriented. Okay, this is how Linux has changed as a development model over time. Like any project, it's adapted to reflect the way it has to be run on the things that are necessary to make it work. It's very different to an office environment or the sort of structured commercial development environment. One of the real obvious offshoots from that is Linux is very modular. You can almost always change individual pieces without breaking anything else. If you change one driver, you have no effect on the rest of the system. You can change entire file systems without touching the main kernel. You can add a network protocol without affecting the majority of the kernel. It's everything in Linux, in the Linux kernel, in fact, everything in most big free software projects is incredibly modular. It's really a maintaining thing. There is no way to maintain a very large project over the internet unless there are very few dependencies between pieces of the project. If everything in the kernel depended on other pieces of the kernel, Linux would spend its entire time broken. By being very modular, you know that people can be changing each piece of the Linux system as they need to, and they won't break the rest of the system. That's not just important for the kernel and for the mainstream kernel. It's also important for people who are customizing Linux, for people who are making modifications to Linux for perhaps a specific customer, because it makes it easy to make modifications. And it also means that if you make a modification to suit some specialist